You're listening to the Diplomat's Asia Geopolitics Podcast. As always, I'm your host, Ankit Panda. And unfortunately, I'm not joined by my regular co-host, Katie, on this episode, but I'm delighted to have in her stead, once again back on the show, Sebastian Strangio, the Diplomat's Southeast Asia editor. Sebastian, it's great to have you back on. It's been a while. How are you?
It's been. Thanks for having me.
Of course. It's always a delight, and I'm sure our listeners have figured out that having you on the show means we're going to turn our attention to Southeast Asia. Specifically Vietnam, where I think we have a pretty significant political event to talk about, which is the passing of the General Secretary of the Communist Party of Vietnam, Nguyen Phu Chung, who passed away on July 19th at the age of 80. So Nguyen was an interesting figure, second longest serving party chief in Vietnamese history, quite impactful for Vietnam's foreign policy, which we'll talk a bit about. I, frankly, Sebastian, I'm looking for just, any sense of how to really make sense of this. I think we'll talk a bit about first the implications for Vietnam internally, and then we can maybe zoom out a bit and reflect a bit on the implications. But maybe the place to start is to help our listeners understand who exactly Nguyen Phu Chung was when it came to his role in stewarding the Communist Party of Vietnam and more generally shaping Vietnam's approach to the region and the world. How do you sort of approach that?
Well, it seems like Chung was a figure who was very committed to the party's historical role, the idea of the party as a bastion of, or a guardian of the national interest. He was somebody who had a very strong theoretical background. He edited party journals prior to becoming a senior high-ranking member of the party and serving as party leader. And he's somebody who, I think, during his time at the helm, sought to restore the party's reputation for probity, moral leadership, upright leadership. His anti-corruption campaign sought to purge from the party corrupt practices that had grown to, frankly, gargantuan proportions at the time that the campaign was launched in earnest in 2016. And he has, his efforts have really shaken up the upper echelons of the party. We've seen, huge numbers of resignations, including of two presidents, one National Assembly chair, and other senior officials from across the party and state apparatus. Whether, of course, this will be ultimately successful remains to be seen. But he certainly left a very strong mark on the party. He's reinforced the party's leading role in Vietnamese politics. Clamped down on dissent. The anti-corruption campaign has also strengthened the influence of the security forces, which have been tasked with investigating cases of corruption and prosecuting them. And so it's, he is somebody who's, is likely to have leave a very strong impact on the balance between, the collective leadership of the party and security forces and so forth.
Yeah, so, Vietnam's foreign policy under Chung, I think, is interesting to reflect on. I mean, when I would spend more time looking at this region more closely, which I guess, probably dating back to more than 10 years ago when I would really write quite a bit about Vietnam and China and the U.S., it was sort of striking to me to sort of recall, Chung's 2015 visit to the White House after the 2014 very visible disputes with China in the South China Sea. So when you think about, the role that he had in kind of navigating Vietnam's relationships with the major powers, here I'm thinking of primarily the U.S. and China, but also Russia, which is an important relationship for Vietnam. How influential do you think he personally was? I mean, Vietnam does have a collective system of leadership, but when we sort of reflect on a legacy of an individual like Nguyen Phu Chung, what should we take away?
It's an interesting question. I mean, there's been a lot of talk in recent days about the concept of bamboo diplomacy, which Chung supposedly masterminded and put into practice. I think that, bamboo diplomacy itself is a familiar term for people who watch Southeast Asia. I mean, the Thai diplomatic tradition is often likened to bamboo. It's not an uncommon metaphor. And I also think that it's not an uncommon the principles that bamboo diplomacy articulates, the idea of being friends to all and enemies to none, to being very flexible in the face of changing geopolitical realities. This is something that has characterized Vietnam's foreign policy since the end of the Cold War. So it's hard to know how much to ascribe to Chung personally. I do think that he, you know, his time as party leader and as really the primus inter pares of the Communist Party of Vietnam has coincided with a period in which the country has managed very astutely to balance its relationships with its various, you know, the major powers, and not just China and the United States, but also Russia, India, South Korea, Japan, and Australia, among others. And so we've seen the establishment of comprehensive partnerships with a number of other countries, most significantly the United States last year, as well as the deepening of the traditionally friendly relations with China and Russia. And I mean, the fact that Vietnam over the past 2 years has hosted Xi Jinping, President Joe Biden, and Russian President Vladimir Putin, you know, I think is an indication of the skill with which the country has managed this balance. But how, exactly how much we can put this down to Jong himself, I think remains a bit more open to question. I think that it's very clear that Jong has left a strong personal imprint on Vietnam's domestic politics, but the international politics, I think there's been a lot of continuity in how Vietnam has approached the outside world since the end of the Cold War.
Right. And so, you know, I think we're getting at something quite important here, which is the opacity of the Communist Party of Vietnam and really what goes on within and how it sort of shapes domestic and the country's foreign relations. And so, you know, looking ahead now, you know, there's a lot of talk about what happens next, the transition, what figures might sort of rise in prominence, what might that mean for Vietnam's approach to internal security, economic policy, foreign policy. Walk our listeners a little bit through what your prognosis is here for Vietnam. Who are the figures to watch? What are your expectations for how things might change or not change?
Well, there has been some talk about, you know, the general secretary of the Communist Party dying in office and that, you know, this would create a political instability. To a large extent, I think the political instability is, or the bulk of it is probably behind us now. We've seen over the past couple of years, as I mentioned, the anti-corruption campaign has become intertwined with personal and political and factional rivalries at the upper levels of Vietnamese politics. And we've seen, in particular, the former Minister of Public Security, recently appointed president, Tho Lam, use his investigative powers and his leading role in the anti-corruption campaign to eliminate factional rivals and position himself as Jong's likely successor. Now, Lam has been maneuvered in as the acting general secretary until the next party congress in 2026 and is really in pole position to be formally appointed to that post at the time. You know, again, it's very hard to know exactly what's happening behind the scenes, but there are other potential candidates for the role. Pham Minh Chinh, the current prime minister, is somebody, is one of the only of the top four political roles, holders of top political roles, to be still in the position that he was elected to in 2021 at the last party congress. You know, he's seen as somebody who could potentially, you know, succeed Jong. There are a couple of generals who are also believed to be, you know, potential candidates. But there's a lot of water to go under the bridge between now and early 2026. And I think that the, you know, as before every party congress, there will be heated backroom maneuvering in order to ensure, to shore up the support within the Central Committee and other organs of the party among these various candidates. And but I think, you know, if I was a betting man now, I'd be having my money on Tho Lam. I think he's somebody who, you know, has, you know, seemed to have it pretty much sewed up prior to Jong's death. And, you know, we'll have to wait and see to see how things unfold. But I think he's the most likely candidate as things stand. Mm-hmm. Internationally, I think Vietnam's foreign policy orientation is unlikely to change in any significant way. We may see tweaks to its approach. But as, you know, as you mentioned, the direction of Vietnamese foreign policy is set collectively. It's not a decision of any one particular leader. And Vietnam's political system does not privilege individual leaders to quite the same extent that China does. We're unlikely to see the emergence of a Xi Jinping type figure who will, you know, mm-hmm. you know, seize control of Vietnam's international affairs in the way that he has done in China. And so, you know, I think that this you know, the geographic and strategic realities that Vietnam faces, you know, its proximity to China, its, you know, desire to reassure the Chinese that it does not pose a threat, will continue to strongly influence how it approaches foreign policy under a new general secretary. I don't think we're going to see any significant changes. We'll see the four no's policy continue. We'll see that, this omnidirectional engagement with major powers continue, and I think that, you know, the there will be a continued focus on, you know, opening up the Vietnamese economy and creating the prosperity that undergirds the legitimacy of communist rule.
So, you know, to ask you to speculate a little bit, I mean, do we have any reason to think that the party-to-party relationship between the Communist Party of Vietnam and the Chinese Communist Party might take any turns as a result of this leadership transition?
It's unlikely. I think that the fact that Tho Lam, if he indeed does assume on a permanent basis the leadership of the party, I think he's somebody with whom China will probably find, you know, have a fair amount, see a fair amount of affinity. I mean, this is, you know, the increasing prominence of the security forces under Zhong. I mean, these are conservative forces. These are individuals who view Vietnam's opening to the world as a potential threat to the party's hold on power. And there was a recent directive that was publicized earlier this year, a leaked directive from the Communist Party, which talked about ensuring that Vietnam's engagement, increasing engagement with the world, increasing economic integration with the wider world, did not bring in the sorts of political influences that could undermine party rule. I mean, there's a there's a close parallel to be drawn here between Deng Xiaoping's idea of, you know, opening the window but not letting any of the flies in.
Mm-hmm.
You know, his metaphor for China's economic, its reform and opening, its economic opening to the world. And so I think that we are likely to see, you know, this persists. And I think this is a view that the Chinese are largely on board with.
Right. And, you know, I mean, on that note, I was wondering, you know, among Western analysts, especially, I've seen a bit of chatter around the idea that, you know, if Tho Lam is indeed going to be the best positioned successor, including past 2026, that could mean a potential change to, you know, the state of civil liberties in Vietnam, a potential crackdown, kind of more chilling effects on speech and other things like that. Do you think that's kind of overhyped, or do you think there's a real concern there in terms of the role of the security services under a potential, you know, Tho Lam general secretary term?
I mean, the baseline is already pretty restrictive,
right?
And we've seen over the past 5 or 6 years, you know, significant intensification of or narrowing of the spaces for permissible dissent. I mean, there's been tax investigations of environmental activists, including some environmental activists and climate change activists that were actually working with the government on its net zero goals. So, you know, there's been, I think, already a significant tightening under Zhong. And I think that, you know, the advent of a key member of the security forces to the interim leadership of the party and potentially the permanent leadership of the party, you know, is likely to see this persist. I mean, it's hard to see how much worse things could get or how much more restrictive things could get from here. It's possible. But I think that we just need to understand that we're dealing with an already fairly restrictive political environment. And it's certainly not going to get better under Tho Lam, if he indeed is the next leader of the party.
All right. Well, Sebastian, thanks a lot for hopping on the show and helping me and our listeners make sense of this. It's really great to have you on to turn our attention to Southeast Asia.
Thanks for having me, Ankit. Look forward to the next time.
Absolutely. For listeners, if you like what you heard on the podcast, make sure you subscribe so you can keep up with future episodes. And if you've been a subscriber for a while and you like what you hear on the show, make sure you leave us a review. You can do that anywhere you get your podcasts. It's really helps the show out, and we really do appreciate the feedback. Finally, if you have suggestions for future coverage, definitely drop me a note. My contact information is quite public if you just look me up, and we'll be back soon with more on the Asia Geopolitics Podcast very soon.